From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, 100 years after the United States entered World War I, Doughboy MIA works to identify our remaining soldiers still missing in action.
We lost 116,000 plus in the war. Graves Registration Service handled over 80,000 burials, and they did the whole thing with paper forms and shoeboxes full of index cards. And the fact that we only have about 2,200 that are truly missing in action, that's a pretty good record.
Later, book critic Jim Higgins takes a turn at writing a book himself about some notable Wisconsin authors.
And acclaimed writer Paul Theroux's latest novel explores how a large family is a little like a country under a dictatorship.
Family is a nation, a group of like-minded people with their own customs, their own cruelties, their own enemies. And they behave differently when they're on their own in the house than they are outside.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It was 100 years ago in April that the U.S. entered the war known then as the Great War and today known as World War I. 11 million soldiers died during the war, more than 100,000 Americans among them.
Robert Laplander lives in Waterford, Wisconsin. He served in the Marine Corps, but not, as he points out, during wartime. But since the early 2000s, he's been actively working to properly identify and commemorate U.S. soldiers still missing in action from the First World War. His all-volunteer organization is called Doughboy MIA, and he joined me in May by phone from his home in Waterford to explain why he started his sleuthing work.
Originally, I was writing a book on the Lost Battalion, a unit that was trapped behind enemy lines for 5 days in World War I, and word got around. I'd spent some time in France walking around the area and getting to know distances and et cetera, and word got around in France of what I was doing, and I got a lot of help. And in 2005, a friend of mine got a hold of me. He said he had been contacted by a French battlefield archaeologist who had picked a few things up at the site, and he wanted to know if I'd be interested in them. And I'm like, sure, not a problem. So he mailed them over, and one of them was a dog tag. And when we did the research on it, we found out it was a dog tag from a guy in the action who was missing in action. So we started doing the research on him, come to find out. Matter of fact, he was originally from Wisconsin. He'd been drafted out of South Dakota and killed on October 5th, 1918. When they buried the bodies in the temporary battlefield graves, he had no tags on him, but somebody must have known who he was. His name was Eugene McGrath, and they put his initials on the cross. When they transferred the bodies from the battlefield graves to the big American cemetery, the cross and the body got separated, and he's in an unknown grave over there in the American cemetery at Meuse Argonne. The more we dug, the more research we did, the more we found and eventually came upon the American Battle Monuments Commission list that shows 4,423 that are missing in action. About half of them are missing at sea or lost at sea. So, you know, we know where they are, but they're unrecoverable, obviously. The rest of them, if we could find the proper paperwork, I know that Eugene McGrath, we could name which grave he's in. So we started to dig to find more paperwork, and it just kind of snowballed from there. And then in 2015, the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission got wind of what I was doing and asked if I would host something on their website, and that's how Doughboy MIA came about. The mission statement originally was just that we were going to take a look at all the case files for all these guys and try to make a conclusion as to what happened to them. And that has since expanded to identification when possible, and possibly even recovery and identification for those who are still missing in the wilderness of the battlefield.
And when you say we, you're talking about a group of volunteers, yourself as well as the folks who help you. This is not an organization where you're getting paid for this.
No, it's an all-volunteer organization. My wife and I run it on this end. We kind of manage the whole thing and oversee everything. When we need help with something, we put the word out and volunteers show up. We have one senior research analyst that we use down in the D.C. area when we have to get to the National Archives at College Park. She's always ready to go, her and her daughter. We have two men overseas, one in the Netherlands and one in England, that I place the emails, and they go and walk the battlefields or look at what I need looked at, take pictures, make reports. And then there's a network all across the United States, depending on where we have to go to dig, that's willing and able to show up and help. Most of the time when we hit the archives, we're looking through a lot of boxes. The last major poll that we did was at the National Archives in March of 2016, and we had a team of seven, including myself, that went through 300 boxes in 4 days. The other thing that we do is in St. Louis at the National Archives, the National Personnel Records Center, is where the burial files for all of the dead from the First World War are. So we'll go and we'll pull those. If I go down myself, I'll take my wife and maybe one or two other people. We'll, you know, shoot pictures of 200 burial case files. If I need one on the fly, we work with a private researcher who we have to pay because it's what he does, but he gives us a really nice deal, and he does very quality work. So we have a lot of people that we can depend on, but it is all funded through my own pocket pretty much, and whatever people care to kick in. The government pays nothing for it. We don't draw a dime from the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission or any corporate sponsors.
Now, the commission, I'm sure, though, is interested in the work that you're doing because it certainly would enhance what they are already doing.
Oh, yeah. The commission backs us fully. They are always on our side, and they're ready to use whatever resources they have available to get the word out. They're the ones that really help us spread the word when we need volunteers or if we're looking for one particular piece of information. For instance, right now, what we're looking for is the burial files for the unknowns that are buried overseas. We've actually been looking for those for a number of years. We've never been able to find them. They're in the archive someplace. We just don't know where. So if a listener out there happens to know, I'd sure like to know myself. So.
Okay, so these are files, they're records of burials. They just don't know who they are?
Right.
Okay. And so, and the actual files themselves, nobody knows where they are.
Right. It's 100 years. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of time for files to be moved and moved again and moved again. They closed investigations on these guys in about 1932. Between 1932 and 1934, they closed all the cases. They decided if we haven't found them or we haven't identified those remains that are unknown right now, the chances are pretty good that we're not going to be able to. So they closed the files. And our government throws nothing away. We found amazing things in the archives, things that have really advanced our knowledge in what we're doing and have helped us along. That would be a major step to find those files for the unknowns. But as such, we have not yet located them. I'm sure we will. It's just a matter of time.
I know this sounds like an obvious question, but why is it so important to you to track these men down and put a final stamp on that record?
That's the biggest question that we get. That's the one that's asked the most. And the answer is the same all the time. Why not? If we can, why wouldn't we? America traditionally brings their dead home and names them. We honor them. We do what we can. These men gave every last thing that they had. They lost their lives in the service of their country. I know it's fashionable to say they gave their life for freedom. When you really break it down, they lost their life in the service of their country. And the least that we can do is try to give them a named grave. Now, in the current case that we just sort of cracked, he was a sailor who was missing at sea. Herbert Hammond Renshaw was one of the very first casualties of the war. He was washed overboard from his ship on his very first cruise on May 22, 1917. He was the first man from Maryland who was killed. And when they're lost at sea or buried at sea, their names are carved on what are called the walls of the missing or the tablets of the missing. Each cemetery overseas has that in their chapel, concrete walls that are covered with names of the missing in action. And we were contacted by Dr. Stephen Genrich from Salisbury University, who was doing some research on Marylanders and Baltimoreans who were killed in the war. And he noticed on the tablet that they have in Baltimore of all those from Baltimore and Maryland who gave their lives, that this man's name was there, but it was not included on our Doughboy MIA list. So he questioned that, and we went to work and started to look to find out what happened. And the Navy knew about him. The War Department knew about him. Everybody knew about him. Somehow his name got missed being carved into the wall. So for 100 years, he missed being commemorated with his comrades on that wall. So we petitioned, we put together the report, petitioned the American Battle Monuments Commission. 2 days after we submitted the report on April 28th, 2017, they approved it. And later this summer, Seaman Renshaw's name will finally, after 100 years, be included on the wall to the missing at Brookwood Cemetery in England.
That must feel both really good that you were able to do that, but also bittersweet that he had 100 years of people not being able to remember him.
He was remembered. He was remembered at a county level and at a state level. He just wasn't remembered at a federal government level in the way that everyone else was. That's an injustice, and it's an omission. When you stop to think, though, that at the end of the war, the Graves Registration Service, we lost 116,000 plus in the war. Graves Registration Service handled over 80,000 burials, and they did the whole thing with paper forms and shoeboxes full of index cards. And the fact that we have so few truly missing, we only have about 2,200 that are truly missing in action. I think that's a pretty good record. I give them all the credit for that. That one name got missed, I'd like to say, oh, that's okay, guys. But you can't say that because this man, like I said, he gave everything. So now we fixed that. And now he will be remembered. And here, 100 years later, we're talking about him. And at Doughboy MIA, our motto is, a man is only missing if he's forgotten. And Seaman Renshaw will not be forgotten. That is tremendously important to us. It's a victory for the family. It's a victory for us. But most of all, it's a victory for the American people.
How hopeful are you that the remaining 2,200 missing service members will be tracked down? I mean, are there going to be some that you're just not going to be able to find?
Most of them we will not be able to either locate or identify. When we look through the burial files, following the war between 1919 and, like I say, 1932, they did everything they could to identify remains and to find remains. What we have available to us now, though, as far as technology goes, is so far above everything they had. We have deep penetration metal detectors, ground penetrating radar, spatial imaging. We can do things they couldn't do. We can see into the ground. You know, they couldn't do that. For instance, we're working on one case right now that they looked for him in 1919, and then they looked for him again in 1926. And when you look at the map coordinates where they were searching, they don't match up with the action in which this man died. And they certainly don't match up with the statement made by the chaplain who buried him. So I got my grounds research people on it, and a week ago Saturday, they were in France and walking the battlefields with all the information in hand and taking a look at the topography, which has changed very little. And they believe they found the trench where this guy was buried. Now it gets a little more prickly, a little more dicey, because if we're going to launch an expedition to go over there and try to locate him, now it comes into serious money. And we have to, you know, tap the French government on the shoulder. They have a Department of Archaeology. Part of their job is to do stuff like this. And we know the guy who runs that department, so he'll back us on it, but we need the permits. And then we need to get explosive experts who come with us, because there's still a lot of unexploded ordnance over there in the battlefield. And the ABMC will have to be there. World War I Centennial Commission, of course, will be there. There's a lot of coordination that goes into it. But before that happens, we have to make sure, really sure, that we're in the right spot. Otherwise, that's a lot of money down the drain and a lot of hopes raised for nothing. We are really, really thorough in everything that we do. Most of the guys that were over there that are in unknown graves are in unknown graves because there simply was no way to identify them. Will we find a few in the battlefield? I'm sure we will. Will there be a couple of paperwork errors if we can find those missing files? I'm sure there will be more than one. We can fix some of those things. And if we could name 3, 4, 5, maybe recover a couple of sets of remains, that's a victory.
Looking forward, how long do you plan to do this work?
Well, the official mission of the World War I Centennial Commission goes through the end of 2020. So Doughboy MIA, as far as the work we do at the World War I Centennial Commission and that website, will go through the end of 2020 when everything that happened for the 100th anniversary, you know, the centenary of the war, will all get wrapped up, stored electronically, and put away for future generations to look at. Doughboy MIA, I have every confidence, will continue beyond that. Our mission, like I said, is to go through every one of the burial files and see what we can do. If we're able to accomplish that mission by the end of 2020, so much the better. If we're not, we will continue until it's done.
Well, Robert Laplander, I want to thank you so much, both for the work that you and your erstwhile team of volunteers is doing, but also for talking with us today. Wishing you a good Memorial Day.
Well, thank you for having me on and the opportunity to spread the word. And a man is only missing if he's forgotten. So this Memorial Day, take a pause and remember those men from 100 years ago.
Robert Laplander lives in Waterford, Wisconsin. He is the managing director of Doughboy MIA. You can find out more about his work and that of the World War I Centennial Organization from a link at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break now, and then a very meta topic. Book critic turned author Jim Higgins talks about his book about authors. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Many of us know Jim Higgins as the books editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, so it's safe to say that he writes a lot, especially in the form of book reviews. But his latest project is a book that someone else will have to review.
It is called Wisconsin Literary Luminaries, and it is Higgins' first book. It's a collection of 10 essays about some of the state's most famous writers, from Laura Ingalls Wilder to Iyad Akhtar.
Higgins' book came out this spring, and he joined us then to explain how he chose the writers he did.
The History Press is a publisher of local and regional books, and they do tiny little markets, niches, sub-niches, and they had done a book on Tennessee writers with this similar title, and they came to me and said, Jim, would you be interested in doing one on Wisconsin writers? And I looked at the Tennessee book, and I thought about it, and I said, yes, if I could do it this way, and they said, okay. But one practical thing is their books come in between 30 and 50,000 words. So I sized it up and realized I could fit 10 writers comfortably in this. And then I made a list, and I looked at a lot of places and had lists of Wisconsin writers because I had a morbid fear of forgetting somebody really important and having somebody smart like you say to me, Jim,
how come
you forgot about Shakespeare? He's a Wisconsin writer. And
it's the little known part of the canon.
That's right. Two gentlemen from Verona, Verona, Wisconsin.
Exactly.
And really and truthfully, one of the helpful lists of Wisconsin writers is at the Central Library in downtown Milwaukee, where they have the Wisconsin Writers Wall of Fame. And that was a list I kept coming back to every once in a while as I thought about who. And then in the journalism world, and I'm sure you've done this, Bonnie, too, we can have a very loose definition of who's from Wisconsin. You know, there are people who were born here, people who lived here. We're always shocking our boss, who's from New Jersey, with the Wisconsin connections of various people you'd never think about. So Saul Bellow spent a year at the University of Wisconsin. Could we claim him, you know, if we wanted to? Well, that's pretty specious. So I decided.
I noticed he wasn't in the book.
He wasn't in the book because I thought not even I have the chutzpah to pull that off. I decided they had to be either born here or spent significant time here doing significant work here. And I kept whittling down my list. And then the other factor was it had to be someone that I felt I could say something of value of. There are writers from Wisconsin that I just didn't really think I could bring you something of value, so there's not much point of me writing about them. So they fell into four groups. I have four pillars, I call them, four just great writers from this state who we have to talk about. Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, who didn't live here very long, but her first book is set here. And I think in a certain sense, she set a tone for what people think about Wisconsin. Thornton Wilder, you know, the most celebrated writer born in Wisconsin, Thornton Wilder, the author of Our Town and The Skin of Our Teeth. Aldo Leopold, who came here as a young man and really worked out much of his environmental and ecological philosophy here in what's a pretty well-written book. If he hadn't been as good a writer as he was, I don't know if his ideas would have spread as widely as they did. And Laureen Niedecker, who is a great poet from Wisconsin and a really interesting study of a fairly isolated woman, you know, determinedly writing. And I should also say, really well celebrated by her hometown of Fort Atkinson. So those are the four pillars. And then when it came to living writers, because this is a book that's mostly sold in Wisconsin, I wanted people who still had a strong connection here and also had at least one classic. And I'll define classic as either something you study in school or something that is going to be read after you're gone. So Larry Watson, Montana. 1948, a classic. My daughter read it in high school. Lots of kids all around the world read it in high school. And I think many people don't know he actually lives in Milwaukee. Only one of his books is set in Wisconsin, but he's a Milwaukee writer now.
Yeah, he's been on this show a couple of times.
And a fascinating guy. Mm-hmm. And his Wisconsin book is an really interesting one. Jane Hamilton, a tremendous writer from Wisconsin, and most of her works are set in this state. And her most recent novel is a wonderful Wisconsin coming-of-age story. Michael Perry, Population 485, is a classic. And I liken it to Our Town in my book. I think they have much in common and will be continue to be widely read for that reason.
Does Michael Perry like the fact that you compared him to Thornton Wilder?
I don't know, because I don't know. We'll see. I mean, yeah. I'm not sure how he... I think Michael Perry.
I would be honored.
I think Michael Perry likes people reading his work, so yeah. I hope in some way it will help other people find it. And if you ever talk to a nurse who reads, they've all read Population 45 and most of his other work. And then Ayad Akhtar, who's a brilliant writer, playwright from Wisconsin, and while he doesn't live here now, he has a strong relationship with the state. The rep is doing his work, and very interesting and happy to me after the book came out. On the rep's next season, we have Our Town and Akhtar's The Who and the What. And then in the middle of this sandwich, two writers from Milwaukee who have really strong cult followings, but I think deserve wider ones. And one is Ellen Raskin, who wrote The Westing Game and a number of other books for children, but are beloved by adults. And Cordwainer Smith. If you're not a science fiction fan, you might not know his name, but he was born in Milwaukee and...
And that was a nom de plume, right?
It was a nom de plume for Paul Leinberger. If you know Bayview, that little street, Leinberger Terrace, his father developed that area and is named for his family. He's a really unusual man, but he's also one of the great stylists of the 50s and early 60s in science fiction. And science fiction writers today strongly acknowledge both his talent and his influence. So I hope I came up with a grouping that'll have something for most readers and some discoveries for readers, too.
Yeah, something where you can read about the things that you talked about and say, huh, you know, I'd like to read more of that writer's work. I mean, I have read some of everybody. Of course, I grew up on the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. And before I knew where Wisconsin was, because I'm from New England,
right. But
we had big woods, too. And so I recognized something about that, even when I was, you know, 8, 10, whenever it was that I was reading those books. And so, you know, she was just such a pivotal writer for so many young girls of our generation and today. I mean, I find that amazing. And as you say, Leopold, the thing in your essay that I really, which really drew me was when he shot the wolf.
Yes.
And he was told he had to write about it. He had to bring that in, and it changed him.
Yes. His friend was saying, well, you have to be honest about that moment. And What I find fascinating, considering him, his whole life and his whole career as a writer, although I don't know that he thought of himself as a writer, I think he thought of the writing as an important part of his work of education, was you see the man change and grow and his vision expand. And he started as a forester, and he wanted to, his side project was making sure there was a supply of game animals for hunters. And by the end, and he would not have wanted me to call him a prophet, but he can't defend himself here. So he was a prophet. By the end of his life, he's a prophet. He's talking about the value of wilderness for the sake of wilderness and biodiversity and humans in an equal partnership with the land. Those are really still radical ideas to many people.
So as you have brought this book out and you've read now some, you've been at Boswell
right.
with folks, mm-hmm. you're about to be at the Whitefish Bay Public Library reading this. What are people saying to you? What are readers saying to you as they have explored your book?
Everybody wants to know how I picked them. And I don't necessarily take that as criticism. I think that's curiosity because it's a small book, not a giant book. People ask about, it's kind of like with the NCAA tournament. People want to, who was on the bubble? You know, who didn't make the cut? And one person I always say is Lois Ehlert. And I would love to have included Lois, but this is a black and white book. And I didn't see much sense in writing about a person whose work is color picture books in a black and white book. So she's in my appendix. But a point I make there is I think when people write about literary things, it's easy to forget about books for children. But you just explained very eloquently how powerful that reading is. You know, after Laura Ingalls Wilder, the writer most people listening to this would likely have encountered is Lois Ehlert, you know, either reading them as kids or read them to their kids. And so I think it's really important to write about literature for kids on a continuum with literature for adults. Most of the other little conversations I've had about the book have been about the writers people like. You know, people want to talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder because, you know, she affected so many people and so many people love the book and the TV show. I was extremely delighted to discover this very quiet guy, and I would have no sense of what he read, was a big Cordwainer Smith fan. And I thought, wow, there's one other guy besides me in the wild who's heard of him. And
I have to say, I'm a science fiction fan, and I didn't really know his name. So that was a discovery for me.
Well, and Bonnie, that's partly a publishing history thing, you know, that he wrote in the pulp or post-pulp era, and the work languished well. And because he only wrote one decent but not great novel, and most of his work is in stories. It's not like Heinlein or Asimov or people who wrote great novels and they've been kept continuously in print. It's taken the New England Science Fiction Association, which has a really marvelous publishing program, to get those stories back in print. But it's also a slightly hard to find mail order book. For example, bookstores can't get it on the usual terms they get most big publishers' books. So it's harder to find the work. You almost have to run into it in an anthology or online somewhere. And as I said, my book, I've compared it in some ways to liner notes, you know, to encourage people what they're reading. And then the other day I said, it's like a K-Tel album, you know, puts a bunch of old hits out there, and you can see what you like and don't like. So
I have to say, you're just dating yourself there.
Yes, thank you. Well, you know, I remember I said I was the older twin.
You were, and you know, and of course, I knew immediately what you were talking about. And
or maybe it's like now that's what I call Wisconsin literature. To do that little now that's what I call music series. Maybe
yes.
That's the more 21st century example.
Of it,
yes.
Or a little, yeah, it's a podcast of a bunch of different
exactly.
Different things. Are you hoping that people will rediscover some of these folks or discover them if they didn't know about them in the first place?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I envision this as a book that would be in the library that students or people would look, if students still look in the library, and their verdict's out on that. But I know libraries are really busy because everyone I've been in has been full of people and often full of young people. Yes, I hope it will lead people to read other things. That is my goal. I don't think 100 years from now there'll be brilliant essays about what I wrote here, but I do hope in the coming years it will encourage people to pick up and read other things and maybe to stay with a work they find interesting but just need a little nudge along the way.
What about a novel or a collection of short stories from you? Is that in the works at all, or you're happy with essays?
There is a half-finished novel from many years ago. I don't know that it will get finished. I'm kind of open to see doing this, and I'm 58, so I'm not exactly young in the writing department.
Laura Ingalls Wilder, as you point out, was 65.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. I think any writer needs the dream or the idea strong enough to carry them through the labor of the work. So I've had other ideas. We'll see where they might lead. I rarely reveal this in public, but over the years, as Borges, one of my heroes, would say, you know, every man on occasion might have 10 or 8 or 10 opportunities where they're a poet, and there have been for me. Would I ever pull them all together? Would anybody be interested in them? You know, we'll see. Now that I've done it once, it has occurred to me, oh yeah, I could do this again. And I have thought about a collection about writers from my hometown of Pittsburgh, which a remarkable variety of people, and it runs from Stephen Foster, the American songwriter, who's from my actual neighborhood, to August Wilson. But we'll see.
Well, whatever you come up with, come back and talk to us about it.
Amen.
All right. Jim Higgins, it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Bonnie, and thanks for doing what you do for reading culture in Milwaukee.
Jim Higgins is the arts and books editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His first book that he wrote is called Wisconsin Literary Luminaries, From Laura Ingalls Wilder to Iyad Akhtar. Our interview first aired in May.
We'll take one more break and then a conversation with another literary luminary. He does have Wisconsin ties, but his latest novel is about an exotic locale he calls Motherland. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
The people are gay. The corn tops ripe and the meadows all in bloom. While the birds make sweet music.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Paul Theroux is widely regarded as one of the finest living American writers, but really he is a writer of the world. His 50-year career encompasses travelogues such as the Old Patagonian Express and Deep South, and novels ranging from the Mosquito Coast to Hotel Honolulu.
His latest novel at times reads like a travel memoir through an exotic and often unpleasant place called Motherland. That's the title of the novel, in fact. It's an epic-length depiction of a large family with a tyrannical mother at its center, a virtual dictator in a closed-off society.
It is narrated by one of the family's sons, a writer named Jay, who does bear a few similarities to Theroux himself. We reached Paul Theroux at his home in Hawaii. It is a pleasure to speak with you.
Mitch, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
I'm going to start in maybe a strange place here. There is a scene in this book where Jay, our narrator, who is a writer himself, finds out that his sister has resold a book that he has signed to her. And I wonder, as a writer, when you encounter something like that, one of your books that's resold, that's been inscribed to someone, does it cut you to the core? Is it an awful thing to do?
Yeah, it does. It does happen, though. It does happen. And if I may say so, it's happened to me. Many books that I've inscribed to people have ended up on abooks.com or biblio.com. Memorably, I inscribed some books to V.S. Naipaul, my mentor.
Sure.
And I was shocked when I saw them. And I even said, what's that all about? And it was really to do with house cleaning by his second wife. That triggered a discussion. And then the end of a friendship, which I wrote about in Servidia's Shadow. And then subsequently, we became friends again. So we're the best of friends at the moment. So the fact that someone sells your books doesn't necessarily mean that's the end of the line. But it does happen. It does happen.
Well, and speaking as someone who has more or less accidentally purchased a book that has been inscribed to someone else, I have to say, as a reader and the owner of this book, it's a strange feeling to have this book in your collection that was inscribed and ostensibly with some thought given to the inscription to someone else.
Yes, it is, because it's a very personal thing of either dedicating a book to someone, which is the ultimate, or then inscribing it in a tender, meaningful way, and then, and then they say that it gives it added value.
I feel like we should talk a little more about Mother. Mother is the supreme leader in the middle of this family that you write about. And Jay, our narrator, describes it as like Albania at its most Maoist.
Yeah.
Do you think is there something in the dynamic of large families, even the ones without this particular kind of mother figure in them? Are they like closed-off countries?
Yes, they are. A big family is a nation. It has its own language. They have their own customs. They have their own little rituals of, you know, what do they do on a Saturday night, or what they do every Thanksgiving, or little sayings. Mother always says this. Dad always says this. You drop something. I remember if I dropped something, my father used to say, lazy man's load. Lazy man's load was taking, you know, carrying more than you should, so you drop something. So lazy man's load. I've never heard anyone else say that. That was a saying in the family. And so a family is a nation. A nation is a group of like-minded people with their own customs, their own cruelties, their own enemies. And they behave differently when they're on their own in the house than they are outside. Outside, there's smiles and everything's fine. It's usually regarded as a big, happy family. But as Tolstoy said, happy families are all alike. The unhappy families, the dysfunctional families, they're different, always in very interesting ways. So, yes, it kind of replicates Albania, Cambodia under Pol Pot, or, you know, what have you. And the mother figure in this book has characteristics of the tyrant. She's not a reader in political philosophy, but she has the characteristic of a despot. She's kind of come up with her own version of brother number one, you know, Pol Pot or Chairman Mao. That was the book's value to me. You write often to understand a situation. I mean, in my case, if I'm writing a novel, I'm trying to figure something out. Who is this person? Where have they been? Where are they going? Where are they at the moment? What is this family? Often, a writer's first subject is his family, because, or her family, because there's nothing else to write about. A person's 21 or 22 years old. They've lived in a family. They go out, then they go to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and the person says, write something. And so they write a novel. Well, what it's usually about the family. I didn't do that. I joined the Peace Corps and went to Africa and wrote novels and short stories and travel about Africa and then Southeast Asia, where I went subsequently. I didn't really start thinking about my family till my father died, actually, and as happens in the book. And my mother took on a new persona, as often happens when a spouse dies. The surviving spouse becomes slightly different, needs loyalty from the people. And they're mourning the dead spouse, but also they're in sole control of the family. So I was trying to figure that out.
Well, and the point gets made pretty late in the book, and by a pretty minor character, that we are all still children while our parents are still alive, which maybe seems like the key to understanding the whole book.
Yes, it is. It's interesting that you should say that, because I often pictured the characters of this book as big children, middle-aged, graying, balding, overweight children, big people in shorts. Sometimes you see people at the beach, and you think, that's so weird. They're dressed like children, but they're big, fat people. Or they're big, you know, tall, skinny people, whatever they are.
Right.
They're old, but they're dressed like little kids. And I often depicted it that way. When a parent is still living, you're still a son or a daughter. You're still a child. And often, if you're near the mother, you behave like children. I mean, spitefully, revengefully, or kindly, as the case may be. But you're still children. It's only when your parents have passed away that you assume full measure of adulthood, I think.
Well, and in that way, I wanted to ask, and I don't think this is a spoiler, following Mother's death at 102 at the end of this book, the book ends with the narrator signing off with the date and place the way a preface would. Should we be looking at the first 70 or so years of Jay's life as something of a preface?
I suppose so. I mean, it is kind of a preface. I will say the last fourth of the book, a quarter of the book, is a love story. And things have changed, as they do. It's not just about the mother as an old tyrant all the time. When she gets older, she becomes a kind of sacred figure. She becomes like a little yellow goddess sitting in the corner of a room emitting an aura. And Jay notices how he's now more forgiving. And then he falls in love. The mother has a caregiver. And it's not a spoiler to say that the caregiver has the same name as a child that had died at birth and the mother venerated. So I guess it's all prologue in a way, that the author, Jay, is not me. He's a version of me, I suppose, but it's not me. He's a fellow kind of down on his luck, living 10 minutes from mother, as one of the chapter headings. If you're living 10 minutes from your mother, really, you haven't gone very far in the world. You're still kind of looking after her. And he's living in a rented house. I'm speaking to you from Hawaii in a very salubrious place, so obviously I'm not him. But I think you assume at the end of the book that he's moving on to bigger and better things.
Right. I mean, I think if we think of childhood as kind of a preface to the rest of our life, you know, he's had a very long preface at this point.
Yeah, that's true. But as long as your parents are alive, you're still children. And in a way, there's still hope because your parents haven't passed away. So this, you don't even think about death. You think, I'm still a boy. I'm responding to my mother. I'm being treated like a child, like, as you know, mothers or fathers often think of their children. I think of my children who are, you know, in their 40s. I think of them as boys, as kids. But they're men. And the conceit in the book is that these are all very badly behaved children in a family who are being manipulated by the mother. But the sign of their childishness is that they allow themselves to be manipulated.
And it doesn't, again, come until sort of fairly late in the book that Jay really starts to question what it was that made his mother the person that she was, certainly at the end of her life.
Yes, it's very hard to know why people are the way they are, particularly, you know, when I was growing up, I had really no sense of how my parents were raised. They were very secretive about it, very close-mouthed. They didn't discuss it much, not because there was anything to be ashamed of, but they didn't feel as if I was at an age to understand. I mean, there was a big gap between my parents and me in terms of familiarity. I had to call my father sir and father, and I had to be very respectful. Nowadays, people call, they don't say, they even say my mom. They say, you know, Betty doesn't want me to smoke weed. I don't know what Betty's problem is. You say, who's Betty? Well, Betty's my mom. And you think, I don't know, it's weird. But so I wasn't familiar with my parents' background. I heard a lot of stories. I mean, for example, that my grandmother was a Native American, a Menominee from Wisconsin, actually. That was cause of consternation. My father didn't know quite how to deal with it because my father was French-Canadian ethnicity, and he thought, well, he was very pro-French, but he didn't know quite how to think about, you know, Aboriginal people. So that was a big issue. My mother, I never really understood my mother. So in the book, you just assume they grew up before the First World War. They went through the Depression, you know, in their 20s, and then the Second World War, and then the further thing, the 50s, which were very repressive, and then the Vietnam War, and then the Civil Rights Movement. There were a lot of pressures and not much money. So basically, they were trying to raise a family, and the past didn't really figure, except in those kind of anecdotal stories that really don't tell you very much. So Jay, the character, doesn't know much about his mother, but he sees little glimpses of how she might have been raised in a narrow, difficult way.
Well, and he is really the only person that we see demonstrating any introspection, you know, sort of familial introspection at all, although I guess it's possible that any of the other characters could have been the narrator, but it's hard as we see them to imagine them giving much thought to, you know, why Mother was the person that she was at all.
Yes, that's true, and it's largely true because each person in a family has a different parent. Depending on your birth order, the circumstances of your birth and the condition of the family when you were born determines a lot of the attention that you got. So the eldest is usually a very responsible person. The eldest is an only child. The youngest, in a way, is an only child, too. But all the way through, any member of the family would have a different take on what the parents. And I should say also that this is a novel. This isn't really a book about my family. It's a book that was motivated by being in a big family, but I sourced a lot of it. A lot of the more preposterous episodes in it actually happened. And then other parts, I mean, the other 40% is pure invention.
I couldn't shake. It took me maybe 100, maybe 150 pages before I started thinking of Motherland in terms of the current political climate. You know, Mother has obviously classic narcissistic traits. We have a president today who many describe in similar terms. Do you see the country going through a period like the Justice family of Motherland, you know, warring factions and people competing for love and affection and money?
I absolutely do. And you notice that the president is obsessed with his family, and he's a classic narcissist, a bully, very thin-skinned, difficult man, obviously with someone who resonates with many people, with me. I mean, my last book was about traveling through the South, the Deep South, and I went through lots of places that had been devastated by economic ruin of factories moving to Mexico or China. And when Trump mentioned that, and Hillary didn't, I thought, this message is one that I understand. So it's two ways of looking at the South. As a patriarch, though, he has that. He's mercurial. He's difficult. People they want to please him, just the way you want to please your parent. How are we going to deal with mom or dad and not make him mad? Is this going to make him mad? And often a parent will say, you know, I'm going to tell your father, or I'm going to tell your mother, whatever it is. So the narcissism, thin-skinned, patriarchal, obsessed with children, seeing the country as a family. I mean, that's rather a touching thing. See, we're a nation, we're all one, and the rest of the world doesn't matter. That was another message that he had. So my novel, Motherland, kind of replicates this condition of a dominant single parent, because you think of Trump not as a married man, but as a patriarch who has this kind of harem. You don't think of them too much. You just think about him. And my impulse to write the book was to write about a dominant mother figure and how you respond to it. My mother made me a writer, not because she read to me and encouraged me. My mother didn't like my writing. She didn't read my books. But as an act of rebellion, I wrote books. You notice now that people are much more creative. They're much more satirical. They're funnier. They're more responsive. They're more engaged because Trump is president. Trump has created this resistance. And he's also made a lot of people think hard about who they are, where they are, and what they want. Hillary wouldn't have done that. So, I mean, I'm not a big Trump supporter, but you can see that how a negative reaction or a negative figure can create a backlash, but that is innovative, creative, satirical, wonderful. And I think that that's what a writer is. A writer has to have a disturbing vision. They can't get medals at the White House. I'm totally against that. I think whenever a writer gets a medal at the White House, I think, you know, you're a lost cause.
Motherland is not actually a geographic place, but if there were a geographic place that Mother's sphere of influence includes, it would be Cape Cod, which is, I know, where you spend part of your years. We're talking to you in Hawaii, and I wonder if there's something inherent about Cape Cod in this book, or could it actually take place in Hawaii?
Cape Cod lends itself to the story as a place that I know well. I was partly raised there. A lot of the story is determined by the weather. The first paragraph of the book begins, "Weather is memory, even the wind matters." And there's something about weather that a certain season of the year, a certain month, a certain temperature often brings memories back. And it does that profoundly, I would imagine, in Wisconsin, I think certainly in New England, not so much in Hawaii. In Hawaii, we have balmy weather all the year, and it's not weather isn't memory here. But big families are a feature of Hawaiian life, and in some cases, very, very big families. So it could play out here. Such a book could be written here about a matriarch, but it would be a different book. It wouldn't be the grind. You know, something about the winter on the Cape, which is very hard. It's raw. It's not particularly cold, but it's very bitter. It's a damp wind.
Right. Bleak. The word bleak comes to mind.
Bleak, yeah, very, very bleak. And also, the leaves are off the trees, so you see it differently. You see it's somehow naked. That's a feature of the book, too, because that's part of the mood of it. But I was very happy with the book. You know, I'm toward the end of my writing life. I published my first novel 50 years ago, 1967. It was called Waldo. So this is, you know, 50 years later, here's my novel, and that's actually about a family and about growing up in a family. and is instead of an autobiography, in the same spirit that I think Dickens was going to write an autobiography, but he wrote David Copperfield instead. David Copperfield isn't his life, but it's a great novel. And I think I wanted to write a great novel rather than a mildly interesting autobiography.
Well, I think you have succeeded. Paul Theroux, it has been a true pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we'll see you in Milwaukee one of these days.
You definitely will. Thanks, Mitch. I look forward to it.
Paul Theroux is the author of more than 40 books, including novels, short stories, and travelogues. His latest is the novel Motherland. One part of Theroux's lineage led directly from Wisconsin. We reached him at his home in Hawaii. Our interview with him first aired in June.
And that's the Monday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because fresh air is next.